I heard something very strange today about I never even thought of. So a shirt, a t-shirt has
Okay.
three holes, right? It's a
Right.
head hole and two arm
Four
holes. And
holes.
I guess four, depending how, yeah, right. So it's called a shirt, a singular shirt.
Yeah.
Pants have the same amount of holes. Like it, and why are they pant mul plural?
Pants have less holes by one, but I concur. What was I
I
trying
don't
to say? I was trying to say something the other day and I couldn't come up with the plural of it. It wasn't like moose, meese, but it was something similar.
It's not meese. I know
It's
that.
definitely not meese.
All right, we should do this podcast, I think, instead of talking
Got
about pants. Think about it. Think about it, though, and get back to me.
Got it.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted. I am Ed Hydock, and here, as always, is my co-host, my partner in crime, Melissa Spivey.
Hey.
And we are in episode four of our first block, and we've been covering cases that ended in a conviction without a victim's body. And today we're going to be wrapping up the block, the theme, with some thoughts that we've had while recording the first three episodes. And then Melissa is going to bring us kind of one other really interesting true crime case that ended in a no-body conviction. So before we dive into all of this, I want to chat about Bruce Blackwood. So that's the case we've been focused on for the past 2 weeks. And so
Yeah.
now that we've had time to like absorb everything, Melissa, I want to get your kind of final thoughts on the Bruce Blackwood case, because I really tried to cover some of the issues that police had with this particular case, which it wasn't so much a whodunit, but it was kind of like a how do we catch Perez case.
Yeah.
But you see how even with a suspect in the crosshairs, scoring a conviction takes so much work. I mean, years in this case. And fortunately, detectives did an awesome job, with building a mountain of circumstantial evidence, and that helped the prosecutor, Melissa Carvajal, who we touched on. She's incredible. She put Perez behind bars in her first bodiless case that she ever prosecuted. So,
That's
and
so
there was,
cool.
it's awesome, right? And there was something that I cannot believe we forgot to mention, because there's a quote,
Oh my gosh.
right? So you found this disturbing, and I agree with you, but
Oh
it was,
yeah.
yeah. So tell us the quote that we forgot. This came from Perez himself. So,
So, and this was on the phone call with his daughter when he
correct.
was kind of bragging like about the murders. So he said to his daughter, quote, "It's not about committing the perfect crime. It's just about how well you clean it up." End quote.
And that stuck with
Wow.
you, right? Like
Yeah.
you've been ever since we talked about covering the Bruce Blackwood case, you've been talking about this quote. So what is so disturbing about it?
I think what grossed me out the most and stuck with me is, again, he's bragging, which is gross. And he just seems so smug about it, like the perfect crime. It's about how well you clean it up. Like, I know I'm gonna win this. I know that the detectives and police aren't gonna be smart enough to tie me to this. And if I remember correctly, he did do a decent job of cleaning up,
Did a very good
which
job.
is really frustrating. But honestly, like, I wish I could write a letter to him and put this in there and be like, so tell me about your cleanup job. Tell me how that went.
It was just, it really shows just a complete lack of remorse. And a lot of times some of these guys will feel guilty, and that gives you some insight into who Perez really is. I mean, this guy
Oh,
had zero
absolutely.
remorse, and a lot of them have zero remorse until either A, they're caught, or B, it comes time for sentencing or an appeal, and then all of a sudden they're changed, and they now have remorse for these. I mean, what he did to Bruce Blackwood, I mean.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of these guys have selective remorse. But Perez didn't have any at all.
Right. Which
You
just
know
shows you, yeah.
what other quote really makes me sick, if like especially if you really think about it, when
What's
he
that?
talked about cutting chicken.
Yeah, that it was the chopping up Bruce
It's
Blackwood was like
disgusting.
cutting a piece of chicken. I mean, that's what he thought of this guy.
Right. And exactly.
You hear the people that spoke about Bruce. If you watched any of the programs on the Blackwood case, you'll see mm-hmm. detectives, you'll see friends, you'll see people talk about Bruce Blackwood in the greatest light possible. And yeah. to have somebody come in and be like, actually, he was a piece of chicken to me. So
that's
that
sick.
I cut up. It's sick. And this is an interesting kind of a. You heard how frustrated Steve was with the case during last week's when we interviewed Detective Steve Phelan. Yes. If you guys have missed that, check that out. He made no bones about the fact that this was a challenging case that bothered him for years. And he had to like pseudo retire without it being solved. Luckily, he had a chance to kind of stay involved. But the people in this case were incredible. And we're going to talk later in this particular episode about grief. And how families deal with things like this in mm-hmm. these cases where there's no body. But in general, let's say there was a body, it doesn't matter. We, for our episode of Cold Case Files on the Blackwood case, we interviewed Tina Namakoudis. And this is something that I wanted to bring up, but I didn't find a good place to talk about it. So
just a reminder, Tina was Bruce's like best friend.
Tina, we filmed, this all took place in New York City, as you know. Mm-hmm. So when you film in New York City, you do run the risk. It's a bustling, busy place. And anybody who's ever been there, the second you step off the bus or the train or your car, I mean, you know, it's this hub of activity. It is loud. So when you film there, it's hard to find sound safe spaces where you're not going to be interrupted by construction noise, by traffic, by talking or yelling or whatever. So we interviewed Tina. I talked to her for weeks to get this interview lined up and just assure her that we are going to tell the story the right way. And Tina was all for it. So we get to the interview. Sound guy says, yep, good to go. So everybody gets the all clear and we start her interview. And it gets back to the studio when we find out it's completely unusable. So
The whole interview.
I mean, it was this droning noise. There was I mean, it's so difficult. We try to find spaces that are safe, but it doesn't always work out. So unfortunately, Tina did this whole interview. She cried. She poured her heart out about Bruce and we couldn't use any of it. So these are emotional steps for people to participate in shows about murdered loved ones. It's difficult. Yeah. So I had to go back to her and ask the ultimate favor. I was like, everything you just told us, can you do it again? Because we can't use any of the interview that we shot.
Can you relive this tragedy?
Right. So now you're pulling that. Participating in these things it's emotional. I mean, I talk to these people on the phone and they'll call me the week before, the day before and get cold feet. And it really is you need to nurture the whole thing from start to finish in order to make everyone feel safe. And Tina, unfortunately, we had to get her back in the chair. And if anyone has watched the show, she's in a black shirt. She's kind of she's a little flat. And this is through mm-hmm. no fault of Tina's. She had just gone through it a week earlier. So it's another stage of grief. This crime happens and you deal with it. Then the trial comes up. Whenever they catch the guy, the trial comes up and all this stuff comes flooding back. Then it's over and you start the healing process. And then the vultures come, all the TV shows, all the podcasts, all the shows, all the news stations. They want to talk to these people. And every time that happens, it drags all this stuff back up. So that is an overlooked stage of the grieving process that I've learned.
Just while we're talking about this, in a future episode, I would love to discuss the people who insert themselves in investigations by them, like they seek out the news stations.
There are definitely people like that.
You know, that would be interesting to do like a case or two on.
Well, and in our next theme, we're actually going to be doing an interview with someone close to the case in a little bit different way. But we had an experience like that. That we'll share with you guys.
Oh, I don't even know this.
I don't think you do.
Oh, so I'm excited.
Anyway, so that is those are kind of our final thoughts on Bruce Blackwood. And going back to just bodiless cases in general, we realized that in week one, we never really gave you any statistics on these. We talked about some historical moments, but there are actual numbers associated with this. So Melissa, hit us with some facts.
All right. So I have a quick... Just a few quick stats on no body cases. So there's this gentleman named Ted DiBiase, and he's a former assistant United States attorney in D.C., and he wrote a book on no-body homicides, and he's still consulted on no-body cases across the U.S. even today. His nickname and his ex, Twitter ex, whatever handle, is literally, quote, the nobody guy, end quote.
Like, this guy, he's got a whole shtick.
I went on his website, and there is like a link where it's like, you know, reach out to us about consulting on a case.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really cool. But Tad states that as of 2020, the conviction rate of nobody cases was 86%, which is crazy high and is actually 16% higher than the conviction rate for all murder cases, like in general.
That blows my mind. Blows my mind. Because you just hear about how difficult these things are to solve. And when you hear that number, it's like anybody on the outside could be like, no, pretty good odds, you know? And I guess it's just, it's all the work that's put in. And because I think these things are so, they're becoming more common now with technology, but I mean, I think that comes down to that, is that they can get these cases in a good place to score these convictions. It's just proof of how all of this other evidence comes together.
Well, and actually, the conviction rate for murder cases is 70%. So this is 86%. No body or 86%. This is 70. Like, isn't that nuts?
That is nuts. You would think it would be highly skewed the other way around.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a lot higher than I thought. And you know what else I thought of? And I didn't note this, so I'm not going to give the exact stats. But there was something about these no-body cases. Like, more than half have been solved since just 2000. Just because we're advancing so much in science and technology.
Sure.
And yeah. So I thought that was interesting. I will have to pull the numbers.
Well, hopefully, if that technology persists and these cases continue to be solved, a lot more families are going to get answers.
I hope so.
Fingers crossed, man. This would be awesome. Keep the train rolling. You know, was there like a moment in history where this whole phenomenon started, like the very first nobody conviction on record?
Oh, that's a loaded question. If you Google that, you're going to get 100 different answers. Some sources, and I saw this the most, is credited as being the first no-body case. And I mean, Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, like, they claimed this. So they claimed that the first no-body case was in 1812 in Vermont. However, and actually, I sort of remember the story, but two guys were charged with the murder. I think it was their brother-in-law.
Okay.
And then a few years later, someone saw this guy in Dover, Delaware.
Was that I remember bits and pieces of that case, but it wasn't even like someone saw him. It was someone said they saw him. And they were like, okay, must not
be. All right, well.
Yeah. So I do remember that. So
yeah. So a lot of places say that one, but if you Google literally, quote, first nobody case in the United States, end quote, most sources, including like the New York Times and Associated Press, they agree that the murder of Evelyn Throsby Scott in or around 1955 was the first case. Do you know that case?
I sort of remember that. I think it was a husband. Didn't the husband do it?
Uh-huh. It's always the husband. There's even t-shirts that say that.
Right.
So I know this case has been covered a bunch, so I'm not going to go into crazy detail, but Evelyn's husband, and his name was Leonard Ewing Scott, he was convicted in 1957 of her death, although her body was never found, but the evidence was pretty strong with that. Apparently, shortly after Evelyn went missing, Leonard had started a fire, and neighbors actually called the police to complain about the stench that the fire gave off.
Do you ever think about how brazen, I mean, put yourself back in the 80s. I know I'm a little older than you, but so like, I remember the 80s and the advent of DNA just kind of, it opened up so many new avenues. And I feel like killers back in the day were so brazen because they had no clue that any of this was on the horizon. So this guy's just out starting a little fire, burning, like, and things like that, or the people that that committed sex crimes with no regard for where they left any biological evidence, because what's DNA? They're never going to catch me. They're going to have to see me, or someone's going to have to rat me out for them to catch me.
Exactly.
So it's wild. Yeah.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And I often wonder what these people, I shouldn't say men, women, whatever, people, if they're in like 60, their 60s, 70s, 80s, and they're like, OMG, I'm going to get caught. Like, you know what I mean? Like they're stressing out about a crime they committed back in the 70s or something.
Guarantee it. I've done cases where the perpetrator, they've said, they flat out said to police, like, I was wondering when you were coming for me. Like, they'll, when they do confess, it's like this weight lifted. And so they, can you imagine though, you commit a crime back in the 60s and all of a sudden you start hearing news about genealogical DNA and all these advances. You're like, I'm screwed.
And then you find out your second cousin three times removed did 23andMe. And
yeah, right. Thanks a lot, Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cousin Jack. Yeah.
Well, I honestly hope they keep catching people that way because it's so cool.
No, it's such an interesting topic, and I'm really glad we picked it to start.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I know that you and I could talk about it for hours, but there's just so many cases. But I actually have one more no body case that was too crazy not to tell you about. And I'm going to tell you the story. It's short, but I thought it needed to be shared. And, you know, if you're interested in more information, you can hit us up on our Facebook page and maybe we can start a discussion chat group about the case. So I picked this case in part because it's about this incredibly, like, beautiful, kind, intelligent woman. And her murder didn't get the attention it deserved. Well, it didn't get the right attention, I should say. So I've heard this phrase said before. I don't know that you have. Have you ever heard the phrase less dead?
I feel like I have. And doesn't it refer to people who...
Like the victim is less...
Is less dead. Less it's than, like... Yeah. Isn't it like people considered like less of a human being in some people's eyes? Like their murders aren't important, or why would people care about their murders?
So the actual definition, according to an article by Lauren E. Fernandez for William & Mary Law School, the term less dead is used in criminal investigation and journalism to refer to, quote, people whom society has deemed less important. These are marginalized groups, the people who attract less attention and whose faces networks decide are not worthy of a broadcast, end quote. That's sick.
It's I have thoughts on it, and you know my thoughts.
I do. Now before I get into my case, I know this idea of certain people being unworthy of attention and compassion is not new. And I know it's something we both get fired up about, but
fired up is an understatement, because so I'll share my thoughts on it, because since my very first day in true crime, go back to 2003 when this whole phenomenon was still taking off. Networks, yeah, even back then would discriminate against people who, as you say, are less dead, meaning like prostitutes. I'm trying to think of other examples of prostitutes are the big one. And it drives me nuts because not everybody is in prostitution just for the reasons people think. Sometimes there are people who've lost their job. Sometimes their situation changed and they had no other way to make money for it. Some of them have children. So networks feel like this is a topic that nobody wants to hear about because it's just a prostitute. No one cares about prostitutes and drug addicts. Maybe it's somebody who was down on their luck, who was killed, a homeless person. Their cases don't see the light of day. And it's because they get shot down the second you go to pitch them. It has to be an extraordinary case, extraordinary, or it has to be a rash. You'll see shows where 13 prostitutes were killed. Who could have done it? But they don't care about the prostitutes. It's the case and the person. Mm-hmm. They're only interested if it serves that need to set up a serial killer or something more interesting. Like, it's just these people get passed over and they have loved ones. And just because they were doing those types of things, you can't discriminate against them. They're still human beings with people who love them, and they were still killed in horrific ways.
And it sucks that at the end of the day for, you know, the networks, it comes down to money.
Always.
And what they believe wants to be watched. Yeah.
And it's such a shame because there are so many stories that are never told that deserve to be told.
Yeah. And not even told in like the newspapers. It's.
Yeah. It's just good. I
hate everything about it.
Human interest.
So, I mean, this is part of the reason I really wanted to tell Robin's story. So I'm going to tell you about the murder of Robin Benedict and the conviction of William Henry James Douglas. So Robin Nadine Benedict was born on July 19th in 1961. I couldn't find out much about her early life. Again, the attention that she and her murder received in this case was incredibly skewed. I do know she was from Boston, Massachusetts. Seems like she had a really good childhood, pretty standard. She was gorgeous. I know I showed you the picture earlier and we'll put one up.
Mm-hmm. She was incredibly gorgeous.
Oh my gosh, like beauty queen. So, and up until her late teens, really, she seemed to be destined for greatness. She had dreams of becoming a graphic designer. She graduated from Votech school. She actually did a year at RISD, which is the Rhode Island School of Design.
Wow.
It's a really good school.
She had big things out of her.
She really did. And I just saw this right before we signed on to record. But apparently when she was in college, she was going out with a Patriots linebacker.
Oh.
And he took her to some party and there was gentleman there who mentioned to Robin that she could make a lot of money in sex work.
Wow.
And her boyfriend was like, no, she's not gonna do that. But she was like, that could be a way to make money. So apparently that's how it kind of happened.
Interesting.
So did you know Boston once had a red light district?
I did not.
I did not either. It was actually referred to as the combat zone.
I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, no. I know. So it might not have been the best place to hang out. So Robin found herself employed as a sex worker at sort of a massage place. One of her clients was this guy named William Henry James Douglas, and he was actually a professor of anatomy at Tufts University Medical School.
Wow. So he was white collar, too.
Oh, my. Absolutely.
Wow.
And he had a doctorate from Brown. So this guy was no dumb, like, he was no dummy.
Yeah.
Well, so.
Yeah, you want to rephrase that? You want to think
yeah.
Again?
Yeah. Yeah, right. So Robin and William met in the spring of 1982. I think it was in April. And he quickly became one of her best clients. He was fascinated by her. And at the time, she was charging about $100 an hour. And that's in 1982 money. So that would actually be about $325 today. So $325 an hour, essentially.
Wow.
I can honestly say that I don't know what the going rate for a sex worker is, Ed.
don't lump me into this. I mean, I'm probably not that much.
Anyway, he started out as one of her best clients, spending hundreds and eventually thousands of dollars with Robin. I'm sure he was showering her with gifts. Eventually, of course, he realized he couldn't keep up this expensive lifestyle. You can't spend $325 a day. I mean,
it's true.
I could happily spend that each day.
If you had it. Yeah, you got to.
Yeah, if I had it. Yeah, maybe $3.25.
Also need a financial advisor.
Absolutely, I do.
ASAP.
So, instead of him cutting back a little or, you know, maybe just stopping altogether and going home to his wife of several years and mother of his children, her, you know, he decided to use university money to fund his sexcapades. So he basically said that he hired an assistant named, quote unquote, Nadine, which was Robin's middle name. And he used that money to keep Robin in his life.
Wow.
So over the course of their, I don't really want to call it a relationship.
It was a relationship.
Transaction.
It was a business, really. I mean,
right.
You don't know if any love existed, but it was definitely a relationship. That's fair.
She definitely didn't love him, and I don't think what he had was not love. It was it was the want for control, obsession. So over the time they were together, he bought her a car and even a house.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And you're telling me there's no love there? Like, neither of us have experience in this, but like, there has to be some kind of, like, what need are you serving? You know?
I mean, yeah, but I don't think his love was healthy. It was like a toxic love for her.
Okay.
I think there's a difference between love and lust, and a difference between obsession and love. I think that's a fine line.
That's true. And some people who, some of these guys with their, I don't know, they're power tripping, you know, like it's just, like you said, a control thing. So it's not even about the sex or the money. It's about the control.
It's about the control. Yeah. I own you. And she saw this as a business transaction. She's a businesswoman. So pretty soon, William was definitely becoming more of a controlling stalker than of a good favored client. So actually in December of that year, so December of 82, William felt like he was losing Robin. Like, I think she was pulling away a little, trying to schedule him a little bit less. So he decided to break into her apartment. He actually stole her message machine, like when you left messages on an actual machine like an to listen to machine. Later. Yeah. That's it. Answering machine. Machine.
Do you think
stole that?
Man, do you think he started pulling back? Or sorry, do you think she started pulling back because she was starting to see little signs, like unhealthy signs in this relationship? Like maybe this
guy,
this controllingness, not a word, but this control that he's exhibiting is getting scary.
Yeah. And this has become more of a scary situation than of a business deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point she found him like hiding in her bushes.
Oof.
But, yeah. I mean, in
that line of work, the one thing that is common across the board is that it's common knowledge you're putting yourself at risk. I mean, you're getting with people because it's illegal. You're conducting a lot of these transactions behind closed doors or just very secretive. So I feel like a lot of them don't understand they maybe understand the risks, but the clientele that they're dealing with are not always good people. And it's about more to those people than just a business transaction.
But I also think that a lot of these women are forced, so they don't have a choice about who they take.
Well, yeah, and they see dollar signs, and they see dollar signs, but they see they're out there to make money. So maybe they see that money on the horizon, so they let their guard down, they let their morals down a little bit just to make sure that the deal goes off without a hitch.
Right. I get what you're saying. Yeah. I think it all depends on the situation and, you know, how they got into the line of work and just a lot of different factors. But William breaking into her apartment really shook Robin up, and not knowing it was William, like obviously she had no idea it was him. She didn't lean on him for comfort, but he somehow found out about it, and he actually bought her like a new answering machine. And, you know, so he could be this nice guy who was there for her after this horrible break-in that, you know, it's exactly the outcome he wanted. Like, he looked like the hero, and he felt like Robin needed him. So in January, so a month later, January of 1983, William had really realized that, you know, she was pulling away, and she had actually been let go from the place she had been working at and found a new place to work. It was another massage parlor. And so William was upset because apparently this was a less classy establishment, I guess. And so he called the police on her and said that, you know, he just went in there for a massage, super innocent. Wow. And she tried to like solicit him. And as a result of that, Robin was fired.
That's awful. This guy, I'm still getting, like, you'd think the term gaslighting has been around for so long, but I'm still like,
yes.
It never dawned on me. Is this gaslighting? Like, I don't entirely know what that is, but
This is more than gaslighting's more, it's mental.
Oh, okay. So this guy is just doing things. What is this then? Is there a term for this? Like what he's doing and then swooping in and playing the hero?
I mean, it goes along with obsessed stalker behavior, I believe.
Hmm.
I don't know the official law term, but I would definitely file it under harasser, stalker, obsessive.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So Williams control. I mean, everybody wants to feel needed, you know? So then that's how he wanted to feel, but he didn't go about it the right way.
Well, yeah, because this guy's then going out of his way to hurt her in other ways when he didn't get what he wanted.
And it's exactly. just
it's such typical behavior of these people.
It's sick. So he just kept getting more controlling and stalker-like, and pretty soon Robin had really had enough, and she was like, this has crossed a line from a business relationship, and it stops now. I don't want you as a client. I don't want you as a friend. I don't want you in my life. Well, of course, William is absolutely like, get it, girl. So, of course, William's pissed. You know, he didn't respect, of course, he didn't respect those boundaries that she set for him. So actually, on March 2nd of 1983, Robin called William's wife and, you know, talked to her and said, this is what happened. And now your husband is coming after me. Like,
wow. So now
I
they're playing.
Help.
Man, this is like, it's just she's dead. You can hear the desperation. I mean, for that to get to that level, Robin was desperate.
Yeah, and I don't see it, and I didn't get the feeling that it was a vindictive move on her part. I think it was the last point that she could do before she went to the police, which, as we'll see later, due to her profession, she isn't given the utmost respect that she deserved.
And that happens, and you don't want to lump. I would never, never lump all police departments together, but that the reality is it does happen, and it happened more back in the 80s than it does today. Like there was an old world mentality. Yeah. But because I think the exposure to topics like this are making departments aware that everyone's important. And all the detectives, I've never run into a detective that has placed someone on a less dead level. Like they treat all cases the same. And it's refreshing to hear. And it's good to know those guys are out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes me, you know, have faith in the system.
Right.
So his wife really didn't care. She just kind of didn't let it affect her. I'm sure on some level she knew.
You wonder what was going on in their house to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. So just 3 days later, after that phone call was made, on March 5th, 1983, and keep in mind, I don't know if you know where we're at time-wise, this is less than a year after they had met.
Wow.
Like 11 months, and he's so this obsessed.
This snowballed quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So on that day, March 5th, she disappeared. So after a few days without communication, one of Robin's friends and coworkers, she went to the police and she was like, look, my friend is missing and it's weird. And also she had this creepy stalker, William. Well, a missing persons report about a sex worker from a sex worker. The police didn't really give it much thought.
Right. That's a shame.
Yeah. So while this is going on, Tufts University, remember, he works for them. They're quietly looking into William for embezzlement.
Oh, so this guy, yeah.
$67,000.
Insane. And back then, that was, it's a ton of money today, too. But back then.
Yeah. Oh, I should have looked that up. I didn't. So apparently at one point, someone from the university called William's wife. We're talking about her again. And mentioned to her that, you know, he had kind of been acting strange. Like, I think at that point they knew about the embezzlement, but they were kind of calling her to maybe put a bug in her ear, like, hey, he needs to confess to this. Like, that's, you know,
right.
Just kind of feeling things out. So according to an article written by True Crime Nightmares for Medium.com, his wife told the university that she, you know, he wouldn't be a problem anymore and that she had, quote, taking care of the woman at the root of the problem.
Wow.
Are you kidding me?
Like, this is
Robin?
One of those.
Robin? Who's the problem?
This is one of those cases where everything, it's like the Blackwood case that we talked about, like everything early on points to one person. And then it's just like, how do we get him?
Yes, absolutely. But you know what? Like, Robin was the problem. Like, how about you tell your husband to, you know, stay at home? Like,
right.
Robin was doing her job.
Right.
So when the police finally did zero in on William, which, by the way, this wasn't until April of 1984, so more than a year after she went missing, and he said that he only killed Robin in self-defense.
Of course he did. Yeah.
Of course.
It's always self-defense. I love when they stab someone 80 times in self-defense.
Or, you know, they find the victim, like, turned the other way.
Yeah.
Oh, it was self-defense. No.
No.
So he spins this wild tale to police about how Robin came to his house one night and with a sledgehammer, and she was trying to extort him for thousands of dollars. And only after, so he only hit her after she threatened to hit him with the sledgehammer.
And again, so, this was the woman who called his wife, William's wife, mm-hmm. to say, "I'm very scared of this man. Please make him stop."
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Got it, William. Sure.
So he admits, you know, he killed her, but it was in self-defense. All right. If it was in self-defense, tell me why he then took the body into his car, drove to Rhode Island, somewhere in Providence at a mall, and threw her remains in a dumpster.
It's such typical. It's like admitting something, but also trying to soften it. Like, this was self-defense, and then I was scared. I didn't know what mm-hmm. to do. I was panicked. These all follow this formula. You can almost like count on it. These guys, when they do confess, they try to minimize their involvement or motives.
It's almost like he's like, all right, well, I know I can't completely remove myself from this situation, but I can remove some of the blame.
Right. And the root of the problem.
Right. Oh, that's sick. So because we only have William's story, and to this day, Robin's body has never been found, we don't know the truth about what actually transpired that night, but it has been speculated that Robin went to William's house. Somehow he lured her over there. I don't know how, because again, we don't have her side. So between her rejection a few days before and the fact that she, well, not a few days before, for a while, but also the fact that she called his wife and told her about William's extracurricular activities, William got so angry and took the sledgehammer and killed Robin.
That seems way more plausible.
Absolutely. So on April 27th, 1984, William finally confessed to murdering 21-year-old Robin Benedict and disposing of her body. Now, this is where our case differs a lot from the other ones. Because there was no body, he was only convicted of manslaughter, and he was sentenced to 18 to 20 years of prison time.
And again, look at the year, you know. It's I think it would be more strict today. I really do. But go ahead.
You haven't heard the next part. He only served 8 years of that.
It's so infuriating because all Robin did was tell him no, you know,
yes!
that she no longer wanted to provide this service. And it hurt his little fragile little man ego. And these nut jobs, when that happens, they lash out physically. It's almost like mm-hmm. they can't take, no one's going to talk to me like that. Like, get out of here. It's pathetic is what it is.
It's absolutely. And, you know, because he was a well-respected, upstanding university professor.
Right.
No one thought that he could be capable of this. And
if all this embezzling stuff was coming out, too, I think people maybe at the university were starting to oftentimes it's like when something little like that, not little, but when something else happens, people mm-hmm. start to question that person. Like, this is the guy that we thought was this great professor. We never thought anything of him. And now all of a sudden murder's plausible. He could steal $67,000. I wouldn't put it past him.
Exactly. But because of her job, I don't think, I mean, we'll get into it in a minute, but she was almost villainized.
Right. And that's the worst thing that can happen.
Just back to the 8 years. It's insane that he can extinguish the life and potential life of this like beautiful, vibrant young woman. And then he just, you know, minorly inconvenienced with spending a few years in jail.
Yep.
Get out of here. Like that's insane.
It is insane. And it's a total miscarriage of justice. And I've done several cases that have taken place during this time period. And there were laws that existed, and depending on the state, there were different laws, but overcrowding, people were getting let out early. Like there were all these excuses as to why these dangerous people were heading back out on the streets. And it's scary, and communities suffer because of it. And the think about Robin's family to learn 8 years later, the guy that did this is getting back out. I mean, it's insult to injury.
It is. It really is. It's like a slap in the face. So because only after he confessed did he actually attempt to lead them to Robin's body, this is a little bit different like than the other cases we've talked about. You know, he volunteered. He said, all right, you know, I'll take you. But unfortunately, her body was never found.
Because it was a landfill, right? It was like a...
Yeah, because it was the dumpster was taken to a landfill. And at this point, it had been at least a year.
Yeah, and sometimes landfills are can play a role in cases. You know, I'm sure you've heard a million of them where police will go to, if they know something was thrown out on a certain day, they can make grids of the landfill and figure out where certain trash get. They find out the trash schedules, and they find out where exactly in the landfill things were dumped and how long ago they were dumped. And they can. It may not be like searching the entire landfill. They can almost narrow it down. So you have this massive sea of trash, but sometimes you can pinpoint, and they often will find stuff.
So, you know, this whole thing sucks for so many reasons, including the fact that her family really wanted her home. And I only say wanted because I'm not sure who of her family members are still living. But they want her home. And I get that. They want their little girl home. They want their sister. I don't think it would give them closure per se, but I think it would help the grieving process. I don't think closure really exists. You've talked to a lot of victims. What do you think?
I have. I agree with you. I think that I agree with you, but I haven't lived through this, but I think a lot of people would agree with you too. That closure is bullshit. Closure is a word that the media likes to throw around, that sometimes even departments like to throw on. We just want to give closure to this. For the families, closure never comes, because you imagine taking this big part of your life away, and it was through no fault of your own and in the most horrific way possible. So now the challenge becomes, how do we heal? Like the nightmare is never closed. It's now going to affect them the rest of their lives, because they don't have that person to share birthdays with and major milestones in people's lives, births of children, graduations, things that person would have been there for that now they don't get to experience. So every time something like that comes up, it's, I wish so-and-so was here to see this, or I wish my mother could have been here to experience this, to be at my daughter's wedding. And so you don't get closure. You get an ending to a chapter, but as far as the healing, that never, you can heal, but you may never truly be healed.
Oh, it's like a wound heals, but there's going to be a scar there.
Exactly. And these are things that don't end for people. They're nightmares that can be stuffed down into deep, dark corners, but they aren't gone, if that makes sense.
Apps 100%. And it's horrific and heartbreaking. And, you know, one last reason why I really wanted to cover this case, and I kind of want to open this up for a future episode. I kind of mentioned that at the beginning, but this is largely thought to be one of the first or biggest crimes trials where the narrative was kind of flipped and the victim was basically blamed for her death.
It's the victim blaming is a That's real too. And again, if her line of work was different, if she was a secretary somewhere, or if she worked at a grocery store, you know, it would be, oh, this beautiful woman who was aspiring to be all the, you know, and but because she was a sex worker, she got pushed to the back of the newspaper. So.
And it's like, no one is naming, like, if I were to be murdered, no one's going to say what my job is.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, that's not true. I mean, it would come up in an article when someone does this great "She Lit Up a Room" biography on you.
Oh yeah, there. That room is dark.
Yeah, it's dark.
So, this case was actually often referred to as the case of the professor and the prostitute.
So right there,
so
you
right
even see.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
you're making him to be a professor, which automatically makes you think collegiate, university, you know.
Right.
A teacher, a leader, and the prostitute. Not the victim, not a professor killed a woman. Mm-hmm. No, you know, because her job wasn't viewed as a job.
Right, right. And it's just such a shame. And I hope that we get the chance to do a whole, I wish we could do a whole show on the forgotten. Just the people who were pushed to the side because of what they did. And there's good in everyone. And just because people put themselves in bad situations or dangerous situations doesn't make them, you never know what somebody's going through.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's really frustrating. But I'm so glad that you picked that case. I mean, that's an example of a case that deserves to see the light of day.
Absolutely. So, well, thanks.
You're welcome. And thank you. And what that does is it kind of wraps up our block on bodiless crimes. And we want to hear what you guys think. If there's some cases that you want to talk about, we are available on socials. We love to talk about this stuff and we'll chat with you. So reach out, talk about a case that has always bothered you or a victim that had been forgotten that we can somehow feature or we can shed light on their thing. So.
Absolutely. And you know what? If you've stuck with us this long, thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. You made the first round of cuts. So, so we hope you guys all tune in next week when we start our second block on a theme. The theme for July is going to be hedonistic killers, which originally we had called thrill killers, but the know-it-all here, Melissa, explained to me that there's a difference between hedonistic killers and thrill killers. And I don't know the difference. And I'm curious. The only hedonism I know about, there's an adults only resort in Jamaica. So that's the only, that's the hedonism so that is not this. So I'm interested to hear the difference when we go deep diving into that realm. And then I am going to actually in week two, cover a case that is very personal to me. One that occupied a year and a half, maybe 2 years of my life, about a hedonistic killer, the likes of which you may never hear again. I mean, his motives were so messed up, and it was messed up enough where I had the privilege of working on a 2-hour documentary for Investigation Discovery called The Lost Boys of Buck County. And it's a story that we're going to bring to you in two parts because it's so intense and so massive and because there's 5 weeks in the next month. So we're covered.
It works.
So it works out. It works out. And then in week three of that block, we are going to, we would be week four. Strike that. It will be after we tell our Lost Boys of Bucks County story. We will be talking to one of my closest friends in the world. We've worked together for almost 20 years now. His name is Phil Claroni, and he was an intern of mine back in Forensic Files who went on to become EP of several major shows. And he actually was the co-EP on the Lost Boys documentary. So we're going to bring him on. He has some incredible insight to share on that I think you guys are going to really connect with. So stay tuned for that.
Right. Absolutely. And I just want to say that your documentary is phenomenal. I have seen it probably more times than you have seen it.
I think that's true. That's true.
If anyone wants to watch it before the episode, I was able to get it on Amazon Prime. It is on a couple random streaming platforms. And then you can also check out the Investigation Discovery.
Yeah, they have an app that you can use. But it is a pretty pretty incredible documentary. And it was fun to work on because it was like a one-off.
Right.
It wasn't like a series. It was just this one case that we got the chance to really go crazy with some details and things that this was massive. I don't want to give too much away, so we'll get into that. But before we close out this block, there is something that we wanted to bring you guys, like an icebreaker of sorts. And Melissa, I don't know if you, we threw around some ideas, so we're going to play some little kind of true crime. We're going to take you out of this, the sadness for a little bit and the kind of murder and mayhem, and do something a little more lighthearted just to cleanse your palate before we get into some more disturbing stuff next week. So this particular week, we always talk about Melissa being this encyclopedia of true crime knowledge. She's the, do people even know what encyclopedias are anymore? But
no.
You're the Google.
Wikipedia.
You're the wiki of where you have a lot of information and some is accurate, some is not. I mean, it's
like 85% accurate.
So I'm going to ask you five trivia questions and you are going to have to answer them. And we're going to see how many out of five you get right. So let's do some trivia.
What if I don't know any of them and I look like a fraud?
Well, then you're exposed and everyone unsubscribes. So good luck. No pressure.
No pressure. I'm sweating.
Okay, Melissa Spivey, the Wikipedia of true crime. Are you ready to answer five questions?
Yes. All right. Got this.
Question one. And I will. Mm-hmm. Melissa has not seen these trivia questions. I want to point that out. Number one, serial killer Ed Kemper, who murdered 10 people in California between 1963 and 1971, was better known by what moniker?
The Coed Killer.
Correct. The Coed Killer. One for one.
Yay!
Question two. From whom did David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam, claim to receive orders from to kill others?
So I actually talk about him next week. In the Hedonistic Killers. Not that he is one, but he's a certain type of serial killer. Yeah. Anyway, he got it from the voice is in his head, but also his neighbor's dog.
I would have accepted. You got a bonus point. I would have accepted dog, neighbor's dog, or do you know the name of the neighbor's dog?
I don't. I wish I did.
I used to. And
really?
I remember the kind, too. I could come up with it, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, that right. I don't know.
Two for two. Question three. During what decade did Robert Kessler coin the term serial killer while working in the FBI's behavioral science unit?
Wasn't it the late 70s?
It was the 70s. Man.
No, it's three for three.
Proof is in the pudding. Question four. Which song by the Beatles led Charles Manson to believe that a race war was coming?
Helter Skelter.
That was an easy. I threw you one because I figured you
would. That
was
an easy one.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Question five. Okay. Gypsy Rose Blanchard, who was big. If y'all haven't seen The Act, I highly recommend you watching The Act. What a good show. Anyway, Gypsy Rose Blanchard is the focus of that particular show. Mm-hmm. So Gypsy Rose Blanchard, who pleaded guilty to second-degree murder of her mother, Dee Dee, was a victim of what psychological disorder?
All right, it just got renamed recently, and I'm going to be 100% honest. I don't know what the new term is, but essentially Munchausen's by proxy.
You're correct. It, factitious disorder imposed on another, or FDIA, formerly Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Factitious disorder imposed. I'm going to remember FDIA.
FDIA. That's how banks keep your money safe.
That's the FDIC.
Uh-huh. I don't know. There's some banks. I'm not so sure. Anyway, that is all we have for you this week, and we thank you guys for tuning in on this dive into the world of bodiless crimes, and We will see you next week for a whole different theme and a whole new can of worms.
Absolutely. And if you want to check in with us before then, you can get us at www.murderunscriptedpod.com. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on the socials. We have all of them, I believe, simply at Murder Unscripted.
That's it.
So before we go, we just want everyone to remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Can you even buy signs that say that?
I'm going to make
you
one.
One.
Bye.